Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're coming to you from the Santa Fe Baking Company. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. And we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we will be speaking to Sandy Ault, the mystery writer who has a new mystery out called Wild Penance. I'm delighted now to welcome Lothar von Falkenhausen. He is a professor of art history and archaeology at UCLA, and he is here with the School for Advanced Research and will be giving a lecture tonight called The Circulation of Wealth in Bronze Age China. That's at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium this evening at 6:30. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, it's a great pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. Now, Bronze Age China, I dare say that many of our listeners have not the slightest idea what we're talking about, except that we know where China is. What time? This is a long period of history.
Yes, it starts around 2000 BC, and it ends with the unification of China by the first emperor, the one who had the big terracotta army that maybe many of your listeners have seen at exhibitions. So that was in 221 BC.
And so this very long time period is called the Bronze Age because of people's mastery of metalworking.
Yes. For most of this time, bronzes were indeed sort of the dominant cultural symbol in China during this period. And they were used for bronze vessels were used for religious rituals. The number of vessels, the assemblages of these vessels, were tied to their owner's status. And so when you look at the bronzes, you can reconstruct based on them the social system of China. There are also bronze bells, the most technologically advanced bells anywhere in the world in this period. And they embody the most advanced science and technology that China had during this period. They're acoustically incredibly sophisticated.
For an archaeologist, it is quite convenient that the marker of a person's social status and a very important set of objects are in a material that lasts thousands of years.
That's very true. We are very lucky in China, not only because of that, but also because the Chinese during the Bronze Age had a custom of making very lavish offerings to the deceased in the tombs. So when one excavates Chinese tombs, one can get a very good sense as to the status of the person inside. And the gradation of the tombs corresponds more or less with the social order. That's not necessarily the case everywhere else in the world.
Now, when you are studying this, first of all, for how many years have archaeologists been unearthing this material, in this Bronze Age Chinese material?
Well, there are two parts to the answer to this question, because Chinese bronzes have been unearthed throughout time. And indeed, when this happened during the early centuries of Imperial China, this used to be considered an auspicious omen from heaven, by which heaven would indicate that the world was well governed, that the empire was in good shape, and so it would enable the discovery of some bronzes, which would then enter the imperial collections and would be preserved as a symbol, again, for the prosperity of the empire. And so Chinese emperors over the ages collected a fair amount of bronzes. The first, what one might call archaeological research that took place on this material was published in the 11th century AD.
Is that right?
Yes. Well, it wasn't modern archaeology in the sense that people would go out and actually do scientific excavation. They would work with chance discoveries. But they already came up with classifications that are quite scientific and that are at the basis of the classifications that are used today. They also made great progress in reading the inscriptions that are sometimes found on these bronzes, which are in, well, they are in Chinese, in an archaic form of classical Chinese, written in an archaic form of what is still the Chinese writing system today, but you do need special skills to read them and to interpret their meaning. So all this goes back many centuries. Now, modern archaeology, in the sense that we understand it here, with archaeologists actually going out to excavate and systematically trying to reconstruct ancient civilizations, that is not a very ancient field in China. That was introduced from the West in the 1920s and has flourished in China since, especially since the founding of the People's Republic of China in 1949. You know, before that there were several decades of civil war, so archaeology naturally couldn't prosper quite to the extent that one might hope. But after 1949, there's been an unceasing succession of important discoveries that continues until today. China is an extremely exciting place to do archaeology. There are new, important new things coming out of the ground literally every month. And we are not yet at the end. As an archaeologist working on China, you have to be prepared to be confronted with new evidence that will force you to change your point of view on almost anything you may have thought was correct until now.
Now, China, of course, going through its great economic and building boom, is it the same kind of thing that you have here and in Europe? Every time you try to dig the foundations for a new building, you come upon an archaeological site?
Well, very frequently, yes, and a lot gets destroyed because, of course, archaeologists really can't keep up with the enormous pace of new construction that is going on. So, but that's the same story in all industrializing countries. In Europe and in this country, this happened earlier. In China, they are now in full swing. They do have a good system of archaeological laws and archaeological institutions in place that are designed to cope with the situation, but the sheer scale of development now is such that they do have to pick and choose. And of course, there's also the problem of rampant archaeological theft and looting in the Chinese countryside that is very hard for the government to control.
To what extent have Western archaeologists been a part of this whole process and been welcome on the digs and in the interpretation of the material that's found?
Well, before the Second World War, there was some involvement by Westerners. There was, for instance, a Swedish archaeologist in the employ of the Chinese government who for the first time did scientific surveys in the 1920s. Then when the communists came to power in 1949, all this became impossible. The Chinese archaeology turned upon itself for about 40 years. And archaeological sites were treated as a state secret. Only things that had been officially approved could be seen by any outsiders. But
now, was there an ideological part to that? In other words, were they filtering the results of their archaeological findings through that communist ideological filter?
It had less to do with communist ideology than with simply nationalistic pride, I think. And with the wish to sort of assert governmental control. And that wish and that nationalism are still certainly around. But since the 1990s, Chinese archaeology has opened up for collaborative research. Foreign teams certainly wouldn't be allowed to go in on their own. When we go, we do have to collaborate with Chinese colleagues. But that's, of course, also what we would want to do, because the Chinese colleagues are highly competent, and it would be foolish to try to work there without their expertise and also without their connections in the local areas where we do our work. So when I went to graduate school in the 1980s, I still assumed that I would not be able to work in the field in China during this lifetime, and so I was working mostly from publications and from museum collections, and I was working with Chinese colleagues. They were very hospitable, to the extent that they could be under the strictures that were imposed by the government at the time. But about 10 years later, when I was already teaching, field opportunities suddenly opened up in China, and so sort of in mid-career I suddenly became a field archaeologist, and I have conducted my own field project in collaboration with some very old friends at Peking University, which I'm actually going to talk about a little bit in today's lecture.
We're talking to Lothar von Falkenhausen, archaeologist, professor of art history at UCLA, who will be giving a lecture tonight at 6:30 at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium. So let's talk about this. You're going to be talking about the economy of Bronze Age China, the circulation of wealth during this long period. Let's talk, I mean, it is a very long period, and I don't know how many generalizations we can make, but what were the lives of people like from the highest down to the lowest classes?
Well, it was what some sociologists would call a patrimonial society. In other words, it was structured along kinship lines. The king of the Shang dynasty or the Zhou dynasty at any moment was in principle the head of the principal lineage in a system of lineages that were the rulers of various local principalities. And the most ancient, the most prestigious lineage was the royal lineage. All the others were junior branches thereof. And the most senior member of the most senior lineage was the had the most power. It was also the point of departure for power that got devolved onto other lineages of junior status. That at least was in principle the social order. It is more complicated than that. Of course, there were other lineages that weren't necessarily related to the royal houses. They were brought in by marriage alliances, some of them also by relationships of adoption. But it was this very kinship-centered society that flourished not perhaps everywhere in what is now China, but certainly over this core area along the Yellow River and the middle course of the Yangtze River in the south, which is the area where traditional Chinese civilization took shape.
Now, this is a smaller area than what we think of when we look at the map of China.
It is still very large, but yes, it is only a fraction of the extent of the People's Republic of China in the modern age. But it is, even today, the most prosperous area, part of the most prosperous area of modern China. It is the area that is most amenable, for instance, to settled agriculture, and that is where the traditional dynastic regimes of pre-imperial China took shape during the second and first millennia BC. And it is also, of course, on the one hand, it's a kinship-centered social order. From an economic point of view, it is most basically an agricultural society. These were settled agriculturalists. The low-ranking members in this lineage systems, the low-ranking relatives of the ruler, if you like, were farmers. They tilled the land and they would pay tribute to those higher up, and eventually part of this tribute ended up in the centers. So,
what did they farm?
Well, in North China, millet for the most part, some wheat as well, and in South China, rice. And those are the main grains, and then of course vegetables and legumes and fruit and what have you, as complements for the diet. They raised rather little livestock, only what they could keep in a farm, such as chicken and pigs. They had dogs as well, and they may have eaten them sometimes. But no, for instance, no widespread livestock raising as an independent part of the agricultural economy, such as we have in Europe, for instance, where agriculture and livestock raising are sort of almost equal, or sometimes even, you know, cattle or sheep raising actually takes the predominant role. That was not the case in traditional China, only maybe in marginal areas.
So is there a similarity between what the archaeological evidence tells us they were eating then and what they eat today?
Yes, there are many parallels. Chinese cuisine has developed over the centuries. It still develops today. There are many innovations, even during the 30 years that I've been going to China. But there are certain things that we can trace back even to prehistoric times. For instance, when you go to a Chinese restaurant today, you get your dishes, and then you get rice on the side, and then you mix them as you eat, but they don't get mixed on the plate while you eat. And that division of grain food and the meat and vegetable dishes and soups and such things goes back, we can tell this from the pottery that they were using, that we can trace this back to 5000 BC.
How can you tell from an ancient piece of pottery what they ate in it?
Well, sometimes one can simply tell from the shape, you know, what kinds of things are suitable, and when we find certain assemblages of pottery shapes recurring in the households, then draw our conclusions. But there's also, of course, now with the advances in chemical science, the possibility of actually making residue analysis on the pottery. This has been done, and with some really fascinating results.
We're talking to archaeologist Lothar von Falkenhausen about Bronze Age China. Okay, so we have a society with farmers, and there are these lineages of royalty at the top. What did the other people who weren't farming the land?
Well, there probably weren't all that many of them. They all had land holdings, and you have to imagine the landholding lineages consisting of sometimes hundreds or maybe even thousands of people within a certain area that held a territory in common, and then the agricultural labor was essentially being performed by the members of this lineage. And of course, you know, if you had a high status, high aristocratic status within this lineage, you might be exempt from the backbreaking agricultural labor, but probably you were still somehow involved in it, at least in the supervisions. Then of course, the higher ranking members in these lineages also had duties in warfare. They had duties at court. They had to show up sometimes for audience with the rulers, and they had ritual duties. They had to perform the ancestral sacrifices, which is the most important part of traditional Chinese religion even today, and that can be traced back to prehistoric times as well. So these warrior aristocrats, if you might call them that, were part of the population, part of the same family groups that also comprise the farmers. This is difficult for somebody to understand who has grown up with a European sense of history, because it isn't a class system. You know, in Europe you have the farmers and the merchants completely separated from the aristocracy. In China, the farmers and everybody else are the relatives of the aristocracy. They belong to the same groups. This, of course, changed later on, but during the Bronze Age, it seems to have worked like that.
And that makes for a very different set of loyalties.
Well, of course. It makes, at least in theory, for a very homogeneous social fabric. And there are all kinds of indicators that seem to show that there was a great emphasis placed on solidarity within the lineage. So even though it was the aristocratic members of the lineage who were in charge of the ancestral cults, the other members also participated in the rituals and were very much aware that these rituals were being performed on their behalf. Another thing that one can tell from, for instance, the analysis of the cemeteries of these people is you can actually draw out the proportion of how many people in this in a family were aristocratic and how many were not, based on who has these ritual objects in the tombs. Only some ever do, and well. The proportions vary from place to place, and there's still not enough material really to come up with the basic formula. But it seems to be that between maybe a sixth and an eighth of any lineage were of some kind of an aristocratic rank. And then, of course, the rank order was in itself hierarchical, so there were different ranks within it.
So your talk tonight is called The Circulation of Wealth in Bronze Age China. Was this wealth, what was it made of? Was it actual bronze objects?
Well, these bronzes certainly were the most magnificent works of art produced in Bronze Age China. They are adorned with all kinds of patterns, mostly based on animal designs. I'll show some in my lecture this evening. And they were complicated to cast. The casting took place at special workshops that were attached to the major aristocratic families of the period, and they required a great deal of coordination and division of labor. So this is certainly one place where a great deal of wealth was being expended during this period. There is, of course, also agricultural wealth that comes from the fields, and then there is a huge amount of wealth that was traded in the form of commodities.
And was there a currency?
At the very end of the Bronze Age, they were beginning to have coins, but to call it a monetized economy with a real currency is probably an overstatement. These early coins were mostly probably symbolic tokens of wealth rather than the things that you could take into a store and buy something with.
Right. So you had bronzes, you had agricultural wealth, and you had other commodities.
Yes, and also other luxury objects. I mean, jades, for instance, played a big role. Those were very prestigious things to have. But the bronze were very important because of their use in ancestral sacrifices. So the jades, you know, people were wearing on their bodies. They were mostly personal adornments. There were also ritual jades, but the bulk of the jades that we have from archaeological sites are personal objects. Whereas, if you like, these ritual bronzes were really public in character. They were they served to uphold the social order through ritual, and so they play a tremendously important role.
So a lot of wealth goes into these. What did you call them? Ritual sacrifices.
Yes.
What was the nature of the beliefs and of these rituals that people did that they put so much energy into?
Well, they thought that once you died, you didn't necessarily really die. You simply entered a different sphere in becoming an ancestor, and you could still somehow be accessed by the descendants through these ritual sacrifices. And the sacrifices were like meals taken by the descendants in a temple setting with the sacrificial vessels on the altar. And then the ancestors would be invited to join. And they would descend from heaven, from their residences in the spirit world. They would descend into certain mediums. That is to say, usually junior people of the lineage who had this role assigned to them for the duration of the sacrifice.
So they were like channelers who would speak in the voices of the ancestors?
Except that they didn't speak. They just went through the motions. So the head of the lineage, the most senior person that was actually alive, would present the foodstuffs and the alcoholic beverages in the vessels, and then they would very ceremoniously bow and partake of this. This became more and more formalized over time, as far as we can see. And then, with a great deal of bowing and politenesses, they would be ushered out again, and they would leave. And the message from the spirits, that is to say, what they actually communicated to the descendants, was communicated by way of an oracle, by divination. So they had specialized divination priests to do that. So whoever impersonated the spirits during the sacrifices didn't need to do really anything except just to be there and to sort of go through the motions with it. It seems that they even sometimes had little children do this.
I've always found ancestor spirit cultures fascinating and wonder whether the ancestors whom they call on are grandma and grandpa, or do they go back many generations to people you've never met because they've been dead for so long?
Yes, that depends on your status. The most senior lineage was in, or the most senior branch of every lineage was in charge of sacrificing to all the deceased ancestors, all the way to the founder of the lineage. Whereas the branch lineages only sacrifice to recent ancestors, up to five generations. And in the main trunk lineage, the one that was in principle in charge of sacrificing to everybody, the most recent five generations would also be mostly emphasized. So grandfather up to basically grandfather's great-grandfather got the most attention. And then all the others were sort of collectively sacrificed. And then the founder of the lineage had a special cult. So they had a whole system about this. Because, of course, if you don't have such a system, the number of ancestors becomes impossible to handle.
Exactly.
And I must tell you that what I've just told you applies to the Zhou dynasty, that's to say the latest of the royal dynasties of the Chinese Bronze Age that ruled from about 1046 BC to the Qin unification in the late 3rd century BC. They had this system. And their predecessors, the Shang dynasty, may not have had that. And there's one theory that ascribes the downfall of the Shang precisely to the lack of some kind of a system of streamlining the ancestral cults, with the result that at the end of the dynasty, the kings became so busy sacrificing to so many deceased ancestors that they couldn't take care of the government properly anymore. Whether this is completely true is still, this is a theory. This is not yet completely proven. But there's some plausibility to that.
Now, do remnants of this type of religion and these types of rituals exist in contemporary China?
Yes. The ancestral cult certainly continues today in traditional Chinese families. it is now, of course, no longer tied in with the state institution and with the social order in the same way that it was before the imperial unification. The whole social system changed very drastically from the second half of the first millennium BC onwards. So what I've been describing so far is really before then. And after that, the lineages were no longer quite in the same way the measure of social status. This was all there was a more anonymous system of ranks and of governmental administration that came into being and was institutionalized with the founding of the Chinese Empire. But under that system, the ancestral cult still was encouraged. The only time when it was temporarily abandoned was under Chairman Mao, who wanted to destroy the traditional Chinese family system. But that was unsuccessful. It has since taken up again, and of course it has always survived in places like Taiwan and in overseas Chinese communities elsewhere. And it is still, I think, a very basic element in the social fabric of China today.
What do the bronzes look like that were used in these rituals?
Well, there are many different shapes, and they are differentiated according to function. In the Shang Dynasty, in the second millennium BC, they were emphasizing vessels for alcoholic beverages, grain-based alcoholic beverages, also meat offering vessels, which usually have 3 feet, these tripods you see in many museums, those are usually meat offering vessels, and also grain offering vessels. Then at some point around the middle of the 9th century BC, somebody apparently abolished the alcoholic beverages in the ancestral sacrifices. And so from that time onwards, the alcoholic these bronze vessels for alcoholic drinks disappear. They don't disappear everybody. In the marginal areas, they continue to be used, but in the central areas, they're no longer seen. Instead, you know, you get more and more differentiation of, especially of grain offering vessels, and also of washing vessels, and bells. Bells are very important too in this period.
What was the function of the bells?
Well, they were used to make music during the ceremonies. They were part of an orchestra that also included zithers, stringed instruments, and flutes of various kinds, as well as drums. So, and also mouth organs, these magnificent mouth organs that are still part of the Chinese traditional orchestras. And so they would perform music during the sacrifices. They were also, of course, using the same instruments to perform music at other occasions, like when they had a big party.
Well, I was going to say, what was the nature of their social life above and beyond these sacrificial rituals?
That's a very good question, because the social order and the ritual order were so intertwined. From the relatively late sources that we have, one has to realize that, you know, written sources about all this tend to be from the later one-third of the Chinese Bronze Age, and the beginning two-thirds are not very amply documented through texts. But what the texts do seem to show is that at least during this later period, ancestral sacrifices had become very formalized, very staid affairs. And then, but of course, everybody was there for them. The entire family was assembled for them, including low-ranking relatives. And so in order to give them some kind of an outlet after this all this pent-up ceremonialism, they would have a huge roaring party after the end of the sacrifice, when probably they didn't use the ritual vessels, but they would certainly use other vessels to consume huge amounts of food and also at that point alcoholic beverages, which, as I mentioned, had been banished from the sacrifices themselves, but they were certainly still drinking them at other occasions.
So, like many religions, there has to be a wild part and a social part if you're going to maintain the social order.
Yes, yes, that's these two things are interdependent. That's just life, and any religion has to somehow do justice to these two tendencies in the human psyche, and. I think a traditional Chinese religion was set up in a way that did so very wisely. And if you read the early Confucian philosophers, they too were aware of this. And they have a whole theory of emotions that is connected with the cosmological ideas about the functioning of the world and with the ideas of what government should do to channel all this properly. And so the ancestral sacrifices and the wild parties and everything else sort of had their own places, their appropriate places in the system.
When you say sacrifices, what actually was being sacrificed?
Well, the foodstuffs in the ritual vessels.
So not only, I mean, when people think about animal sacrifice, they think of a goat with its throat being slit and all of that. Are we talking about animals, but or also all other foods?
Well, there were meat. It was mostly meat and grains, and in the early stages, grain-based alcoholic beverages. In the food classification that pertained and that still pertains in China today, these grain-based alcohols and rice that you eat with the food are part of the same category. So it's basically those two things, meats and grains.
We're talking to archaeologist Lothar von Falkenhausen. How did you get interested in all of this and make this huge leap out of your own Western European culture into the Chinese?
Well, I was interested in China ever since I was a child. And then when I was 13, I had very fortuitously the opportunity to learn some Chinese in my hometown. And ever since then, it has been like a roller coaster. I wanted to learn more and more, and then I majored in this in university. And when I was 20, I was given a German government fellowship to study in China. And at that time, archaeology for the first time became available as a subject for foreigners to study in a Chinese university. Nobody had done this before. At least nobody from Germany had done it before, and so I became a bit of a guinea pig there. I was interested in archaeology, but I didn't have much of a background. But I thought this was a very, in any case, it would be a very good way to learn Chinese properly, and it would be a very good way of learning things about the country and traveling around the country to see archaeological sites. So I thought that even if I, in the end, I didn't become an archaeologist, it would still be time well spent. And then, of course, once I actually got involved in this and I found out how important all this was and what it contributed to a really new understanding of Chinese civilization, it became obvious that that's what I wanted to do as my particular specialty within Chinese studies.
And so you learned Chinese and learned to read and the whole thing?
Yes, Chinese and Japanese, those are both languages without which you can't do in our field. So I spent 2 years in China straight, studying at Peking University. I also later spent 2 years in Japan studying with some of the leading Japanese scholars. And in between all this, I ended up in this country because the best Western authorities on this subject were at that point here. In particular, my late advisor Casey Zhang Guangzhi at Harvard University. He was the undisputed leader of East Asian archaeology in the West in his time. He unfortunately passed away 8 years ago, 9 years ago.
Lothar von Falkenhausen is a professor of art history and archaeology at UCLA. He will be speaking tonight at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium at 6:30. His talk is titled The Circulation of Wealth in Bronze Age China. It is sponsored by the School for Advanced Research here in Santa Fe that can be found on the web at sarweb.org. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
I'm very happy now to welcome Sandy Ault. She is a mystery writer. Her latest book is called Wild Penance. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you. And I always try to say welcome back to the series because it's the fourth book.
It's the fourth book, but it we're going back in time.
Isn't that interesting?
So you're starting, you're basically, they're all of the mysteries are called Wild Something, Wild Penance, Wild Sorrow, Wild Inferno. And we've talked about, I think, most or all of them on this program. You're very prolific, coming out with a book every year or two. And Jamaica Wild is our heroine, whom we have come to love. But you have chosen to, what would you call it, a kind of a prequel to the other
books? Yes, it's definitely a prequel. You know, I've threaded a lot of background about Jamaica in the series as I went along, because I actually wrote and sold this book first, but then through a series of really quirky coincidences, it never actually came out on the bookshelves. My editor had a heart attack, and it just didn't get shepherded clear through to publication. But, you know, I was paid in advance. The book was sold to a major publisher. And then when I learned it wasn't actually going to make it to the bookshelves, I just wanted to stick my head in the oven. But fortunately, I didn't. I went ahead and wrote another book, which was Wild Indigo, the first book published in the series. And I let my editor know when we went back to the negotiating table that there was another book and that I would be willing to buy back the publication rights if she would bring it out. And we decided to bring it out forth.
That's so interesting. I've heard many times that an author's first novel isn't really their first novel, and that was the case with you.
Yeah, definitely. And I wrote a novel in between there, too, that had nothing to do with Jamaica. And I think it was one of my best pieces of work, but I couldn't give it away free, you know, with money packed inside. So who knows what's going to, you know, hit a nerve.
So Jamaica Wild is a BLM worker, and she's a tough character and a very amiable person. We get to know her. I hope you keep writing these. And at the very beginning of the book, she is jogging at sunrise, as she does, and she's by the Rio Grande Gorge Bridge in Taos, which probably many of our listeners know. And she sees something which she can't even believe her own eyes, which is somebody being thrown off the bridge on a cross, basically a crucified person being thrown off the Rio Grande Bridge. And that leads to a whole mystery based on the phenomenon, the real phenomenon of the penitentes of northern New Mexico.
I know, and you know, so few people in the United States realize that the penitentes, this wonderful penitent, compassionate brotherhood and their sister hermanas, is a living culture in northern New Mexico and southern Colorado. I mean, people think you make this up, but I don't think you could make anything quite as wild up as the penitentes.
How did you research this material? I mean, certainly there's a lot of secrecy to this day surrounding the penitentes.
You know, there is to this day, but less so than there was when I was doing my research. When I did the research for this book, it was mid-90s, and I was literally chased out of Abiquiú by people bearing sticks and rakes and things because I was photographing the morada and some of their huge crosses that they carry in penitence. But I was just fascinated. I saw a penitente procession when I was there visiting New Mexico when I lived in Kansas City. And it was, for me, a little like watching a train wreck. I was kind of horrified, and blood was spattering in the snow, and I'd never seen anything like it, but I couldn't take my eyes off it. I was riveted, and I wanted to know more, much the same as Jamaica does in the book. And soon I learned that this was this kind of selfless, compassionate penitence, this willingness to suffer was a you know, kind of gift to their communities, to their families, and to the world that emulated what they believed was Christ's suffering, that if they suffered, they were sort of bartering us all out of sin and redeeming us from the potential consequences of our sins. And I thought, you know, it seems barbaric, but it's ultimately a really beautiful, compassionate thing that they do. It's a lot, in a way, like volunteering to go to a disaster and help people. You know, it's one of those selfless things that people do, and I'm amazed at the Penitentes. And I grew to love and respect them.
Now, have they been, I mean, it seems that there's almost no area that hasn't been touched by anthropologists. Are there people from within who have studied and written about the Penitentes since you wrote this book?
You know, in the past 5-6 years, about a dozen really good scholarly books have come out. And one of the best books is not so much a scholarly one, but it's a very authentic one. It's by Marta Weigel. But there have been some really good books come out lately. And one of the reasons is because, A, some of the Penitentes are writing. Like recently, a book was published by a Penitente that, you know, practiced in southern Colorado and literally listed all the members of all the existing moradas by name. You know, that's just unheard of in the past. It used to be such a secret brotherhood. But I think when their numbers started to dwindle and there were nothing but elders left, they decided they needed to open up and talk about what they were doing, why they were doing it, and inviting members of the community to take part.
Is it a dying order, so to speak?
You know, I think it probably is, but there are still some thriving moradas that have taken on some new members and even have permitted women to become hermanos. I know you would say hermanas, but they call them hermanos. So, you know, we'll see if they can keep it alive. I always feel like I'm writing as fast as I can to capture the vanishing West anyway. You know, I think we still have a living Native American culture, but it's so rapidly changing. It's good to capture it while we still have it in its form that it's in today. I think the same is true of the Penitentes.
And to do it in the form of a mystery novel, I don't want to give away too much of it, because, of course, it's always fun to read, and it's riveting and scary, and of course, I always wonder how much Jamaica Wild is based on some of your own experiences or your own character, but she goes through her ups and downs and death threats and things like that. But to keep these sets of cultures alive in the form of fiction and in the form of a mystery makes it really fun. It makes it really accessible to people who aren't going to be reading anthropology books.
I would hope so. I mean, I'm an avid researcher, but I realize everyone else's bookshelf isn't just covered with anthropology, sociology, and so on. So, yeah, it's a great way to convey it.
Sandy Ault is a mystery writer. Her latest book is called Wild Penance, and she will be speaking on, let's see, Friday, February 19th at 2 in the afternoon at Moby Dickens Bookstore in Taos, New Mexico, and then the next day, Saturday, at an open house in Albuquerque at Treasure House Books. I hope you make it to Santa Fe one of these days, too.
I know. I was there for the last three books, but for some reason we just didn't get a booking there this time. I think there was a mix-up with schedules. You know, but I am just delighted to be in Taos for the first time. That's where my series is set.
Exactly.
And this is a good book to do it with, because the previous three books really featured more on the native Puebloans. And, you know, there's a Pueblo there at Taos, and maybe that's not the best place to sign a book that a white girl has written about the Puebloans. But I'm excited to take Wild Penance to Taos.
Sandy Ault, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks very much, Mary Charlotte. Have a great day.
You too. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.